The Here podcast is all about reclaiming your power and reconnecting with your mind and body. By releasing our stories and the power they have had over our lives and creating a compassionate and supportive community, we can bring love, understanding, awareness, and healing to ourselves and to all who need it most. Join me in saying, enough is enough. I own my power. I am ready for the next chapter of my life, and it will be the most amazing one yet. Hello, everyone, and thank you again for joining me for another episode of Here Podcast. Today, I have a really special story and a very special woman. Her name is Cindy Rodriguez, and she is the founder of LMU Girls. And what that is a two-year vocational sewing program that transforms Kenyan girls into confident entrepreneurs. It's an amazing, amazing program, an amazing nonprofit, and I'm so excited to hear what brought Cindy to founding LMU Girls and what it's doing for the lives of these girls. So thank you, Cindy, so much for joining me today.
Yes, I'm so excited to be here.
I would like to hear your story and how that led you to founding LMU Girls.
I'm Mexican, and my grandfather worked for one of the first Mexican labor forces in Los Angeles, building or manufacturing bricks. And it was sort of a company town, if you would, and grew up very, very poor, but happy. Mm-hmm. And really the school was in this town. They had their own sheriff. And there was a point in time where the company was slowing down, and eventually my father, right at the ripe age of like middle school, was really forced to leave the school because it was shutting down. The little town was shutting down, and be integrated into sort of an all white school in the neighboring city. And when he went through that experience, I think it really changed my father. He was deeply, deeply discriminated against based on being Mexican and, you know, the color of his skin. And literally, he really doesn't remember much about even his classroom experience, except for usually fighting all the time. That's what he remembers most about middle school. But he does remember, you know, teachers making the commentary that, you know, they're not worth teaching. Just some, when I think about, you know, your middle school years, in fact, I have a son that's 13 years old right now, and the importance and the validation that you need from your peers and from people in authority. Yeah. It just, I know that he was sort of probably both shocked and deeply hurt. And, you know, his life moved on, and as he went through the years, he went off to the military. And when he came back, he met my mom. And kind of fast forwarding a little bit through this, like, I think it's basically like intergenerational kind of trauma that you pass on to the next generation. And it really was landed differently with us. You know, my parents got married, and the one thing they knew they wanted for their kids was to not go through what they went through in, you know, the 50s and the 60s. And so they plopped us into kind of an all white neighborhood. And, you know, by all measures, we really lived a really protected life. We, in some ways, I'm so thankful because I don't really see color. I was a bit stripped of my identity in the sense that, you know, we weren't taught Spanish. We really just became Americanized, and you know, for good or bad. And that was my experience. And my parents emphasized education, and, you know, two master's degrees later, you know, sort of an amazing husband, the house, the white picket fence, all that good stuff transpired for me. But But in the experience with my mother and father growing up, there was always shame, and it was and worthiness, and just this we operated under just don't push it too much. Just we're doing okay. But just keep going. You can be, our aspirations were sort of like, be a teacher, be a nurse. It was never, be a lawyer or be the next president. There was always sort of an underlying limitation to our capacity, I guess. And I think there were also, there was just a presence that we maybe didn't have. We were we worth it? And but then it was this odd marrying with, like, let's compensate on the other side with being overly educated, all hardworking, and I guess that's benefited me. And so my experience was, I did stop working for, a few years when I had my first son, and there was an opportunity that really came up with going over to Kenya to teach teachers and to teach the students at a little nursery school that I was already donating to over the years that came to me by way of a friend. And it was that point in time that I was like, I think I honestly was a little bored at home. I was a stay-at-home mom, but was always active and volunteering, but kind of was like, wow, this sounds like a great opportunity. So I packed up my bags and flew solo, really just bought two plane tickets, one to Nairobi and one to Malindi, and had already made the preparations to stay with the founder of ILAMU, which is an international organization. And I remember the very next day, I was exhausted, and the very next day was the first day of going in to work with the students and the teachers. And we pull into this yard, and it's a very simple school, and all the kids kind of rush to the car, and it's really exciting. I remember the moment, and they were so respectful and sweet. And we're kind of making our way into the classroom, and they break out into an amazing song, Jambosana, and in which is like a welcome song. So we have the morning, and I pull out my Brown Bear, Brown Bear, and I'm reading it so emphatically, right? Because I've read that book lots of times in my career as a vice principal and a teacher. So we're having a great time, and there's this little girl, and I see her while I'm reading Brown Bear, Brown Bear, and she goes over and she runs to the teacher, and she buries her head into the teacher's shoulder. She's visibly upset, but I'm on now, and I'm reading this book, and I'm into it, and I'm keeping all the kids entertained. So we at the very after that session, I went over to the teacher, and the little girl was still with the teacher, and I said, "Is she okay?" And the teacher said to me, "She's just scared of you. She's never seen a white woman." And I remember it just shocked me into remembering, where I was. And it was sort of the beginning of this, like, in this trip of experiencing a whole new world of sort of culture shock, and the things that happened in that culture, and trying to really understand it. I really had traveled up to that point to places like Colombia and Cambodia and Vietnam and some places that might be considered, a little rougher, and always found the beauty in traveling to those places and connecting with people, and never had quite experienced the experience I had that week in Kenya. So that afternoon, it was a great morning of teaching teachers and working with the kids. And so the founder of ELEMU International asked me, "Hey, do you want to go see some of our other projects?" And so I was like, "Sure." So we went. She said, "Let me show you the sewing college." So we proceed to hop on a tuk-tuk, and it's super dusty, and we're going on like this dirt road, and we arrive at this sort of red gate, and they pull the red gate open, and it's this big plot of land, and sort of set off, and maybe like 300 yards in is this very simple sort of L-shaped building, and We go in and there's cows and chickens and in a big clothing line. And I'm just like, what is this place? It does not look like a college. And I remember, it's like this a gorgeous blue stripe on the outside of this college. And I really have no idea what I'm about to walk and do. And I walk up the steps and oh my gosh, it was just like whabam. It was probably a moment that really changed my life. Everything from all the sounds in the environment. I mean, the whoosh of these push pedal sewing machines and all the memories that brought back of my grandma and who was a sewer, and my mom's also a sewer. And then the connection with the girls. I really had no idea all the junk that was in my trunk because at that moment in time, I realized, oh my gosh, I just wanted to grab them and say, I see you. You mean something. You are so worth it. And hearing their stories that week and all the moments I can get with them that week, I sort of shifted gears, honestly, from, helping the children, which was great. And honestly, maybe could have been like a one and done experience for me, going to Kenya and having that a great experience and going back home. But going to that sewing college was like seeing a mirror of myself in some ways, and them getting that their stories of shame and oppression is obviously much more extreme than I ever could have really had myself. But there was a relatability in the sense that they needed to be transformed to believe that they had something to offer. They are so unique, each and every one of them. And because of their set of circumstances, which is, they're born onto this particular soil, into this particular village, into a family of 10 kids. I mean, these are not things that they're asking for, that it just happened to them. And maybe there was the relatability for me was, my grandfather, went through deep discrimination. My dad was born into that family and he didn't ask for that, but these are things that happen. And how you transform into a butterfly is the piece that I knew at that point in time, at that moment, that my life had changed in a way where I knew I needed to serve with that transformation. Didn't know exactly how that was going to happen, but I knew it impacted me. And in that same day, let me lay the groundwork here. I happened to go at a time where it was pre-elections, and some of the moms of the girls had were from a village where where's tribal conflict, and literally like 3 weeks before, maybe 40 people had died in this particular village area where there was a clash, and so the moms had traveled through the bush and were being housed in another little area, like a compound area of the college. And so basically it's almost like the most similar thing would be a refugee camp. They were really called IDPs, which is internally displaced people, and fleeing really for the safety of their lives. And on the way down, one of the women in the group was a friend of a mom, and she had a baby in the bush on the way down. And so I said, okay, let's go. They, again, not exactly knowing what I'm walking into, but willing to go because I'm adventurous at heart. And so I remember when we were walking, just seeing things, and it was just surreal because there was a little boy sitting on sort of this like stump. And you have this picture of like those 70s poster kids with the big stomachs, and just walking past him thinking, oh my gosh, that, it was soul crushing because he looked hungry. He looked just sad. And then I proceeded to go into sort of this area, this compound area where the women were staying. And I there was a woman in there who was breastfeeding, and I came to her, and she raised her hand really slowly, and I shook her hand, and I was ashamed of myself because I was having thoughts of like, oh my gosh, what, I don't want to catch anything. I was scared. I honestly was scared. And it was another moment in time that I said to myself, I can't go home and forget these people. I just can't. And I knew then that I needed to raise awareness and start a 501c3 when I got home. So that was the beginning of me starting LMU Girls. I started it in 2013, and I honestly can say that, the conflict I had within myself and then sort of hopping in between these two worlds and coming back home, it's taken 6 or 7 years to sort of work on Cindy. And I've the why of what I do has never been a question. I mean, it is solid as a rock. Human rights belong to everybody, and it's the baseline of my work. But the how I get there has been somewhat of a struggle over the last 7 years, because the mirror that sort of happened the moment I walked into that college was something I sort of, they say the quote, where you go, you have to take yourself with you. And when I came home, I was sort of treating it like a mom project. At least once a year I would raise money, and amongst my friends and family, I would ask them to donate. But I wanted to do more, but I just didn't know how. I was afraid myself. I always felt like, I was overly considerate in the way that I was afraid to share the story at a cocktail party. I didn't want to be that girl that was like, you want to talk about female genital mutilation? Here we go. And, I had a lot of trepidation over the years with dealing with not even realizing that I had so many shame issues as well, or worthiness issues, or, all the things that I've sort of worked through over the years. And yeah, that kind of, I think, last year I went to Kenya again in November, and it was a completely different experience in the way that it was inspiring. The joy these girls have and hold, and the hope that they represent, is so powerful. For years, people have applauded me saying, oh, if I do a triathlon or I do a 10K, I mean, really, it's peanuts in comparison to what these girls have done for me. And it's not really even about being humble when someone says to me, gosh, this is so amazing, Cindy, that you do that. And it's like, what's amazing is her story. And I'd like to pop right into what her story is.
Yeah,
I'd
I would love
love
to
to
hear,
hear.
because
Yeah.
the sewing school, why that is so important. I would love to hear her story.
Yeah, so the program itself, LMU Girls, is a 2-year college program where they learn the craft of sewing. But we're far more than that, because we know that the underlying three things that we do is help her find her voice, help her create choices in her life, and really to have a bank account, to be an income generator. And so with the college, it's, the vocation is beautiful, and I love the sewing vocation itself. But in addition to that vocation, it's really a time to help her build her confidence and her courage. And we do that in so many ways. We're an all Kenyan-led leadership team, and many of our teachers and the founder have come from the villages that we source our girls from. So within like about a 90-mile radius of Malindi, which is a semi-urban city off the Indian Ocean in Kenya, are these villages that are very, very difficult and remote. They're difficult to get to. And the set of circumstances in these villages are incredibly difficult to even fathom here, as an American. It's really survival mode. It really is sort of the vision of waking up in the morning and going to get your water. There's no power, no electricity. They don't own cell phones. It's quite unrelatable. And so laying the groundwork for where these girls come from, the cultural influences are heavily based on religion as well. So there's Muslim villages, there's Catholic and Christian villages, and I'll give you an example and put it in the context of one of our girls named Saida. Saida was born into a family of 9 children. She, in the morning, for example, would wake up. She was the third born, I believe, and she would wake up, and really her responsibility from the moment she's been born has been to take care of the family, to feed the family. In this environment, for parents that are so impoverished and living in survival mode, it's a burden to have a daughter, and it's celebrated to have a son, because the daughters, when they do get married, will go to live with the husband's family, and serve the husband's family. They're really treated as property. Indentured service is not a stretch to say that's how I would compare many of these rural village girls, how they're treated from the moment they're born. So Saida's day might consist of, again, going to fetch water, really prepare the meals, take care. Easily she will not, will skip school because whether it's harvest season, she needs to take care of a sick brother or sister. There's a myriad of reasons why she wouldn't be allowed to go to school. And in a good situation where she can go to school, never will she be able to go to school beyond eighth grade, because now it costs money for the family to send them to school beyond eighth grade. And that money will be dedicated to the brother, if they even have that money to dedicate. So the second class citizenship piece is alive and well. And for Saida, she happened to come from a Muslim background, and she was 16, and she got wind that her dad and her brother were discussing a dowry and having her get married. And so a dowry is basically what we call child bride. Sorry, someone's coming in. And so child bride is where, in this context, is where a dowry is when the parents receive money, or maybe a cow or a cow and a chicken, in exchange for their daughter's hand. And then the daughter goes and lives with the husband and their family and serves them. So when you have 9 kids, imagine that, and you are struggling to feed your family, the law and the policy in Kenya is that they have to be 18 years and older, but it's a challenge for these families. And it is very attractive to have them marry off, when they believe they come of age, which is, 13, 14. In Saida's case, it was 16. And she got wind of this and decided to chop off all her hair. And I love Saida's story because the dad was furious, yes. But when she chopped off her hair, she knew it represented that she was still somewhat of a little girl. And she wouldn't have this threat of being married. And we got wind of this story, and Saida was asked to join LMU Girls. And LMU Girls provided the scholarship for Saida, for her to be with us for 2 years and to board with us for 2 years. And we don't, as LMU Girls, we know that that we want her to go back to her village. And so we need to gain the support of the family, and we need to gain the support and the trust of the local leadership, because it working hand in hand with them is vital for the change that we want to see happen for all the girls in the villages. So we did talk to the parents, and Saida joined LMU Girls. And, when a girl like Saida comes through the college, and the transformation that happens is, yes, she gains the skills and the business skills and all the budgeting discussions and so forth. But really what happens is that we help Saida understand that she will be the first to face so many firsts, really, which is first female entrepreneur, first girl to go back to her village and say, "You know, Auntie, I don't think we should be doing female genital mutilation on my sister. It really, medically is not proven." She's the first to have these conversations. If we don't, if it, the pattern will never be broken until someone breaks it. And I remember the very first time I came back from Africa, a very dear friend had said to me, "So did you change Africa?" And I thought, you know what? That's crazy. No, it's not our intent to change Africa. It's not our intent to change Kenya. It's our intent to help her realize that there's a different lane of life. And her basic human rights of not having to have to be married at 16, we can help you hop on the lane of life that says, I can take care of myself. And not in a selfish way. It's really in a way of, you go back and ask it. I mean, when Saida goes back to her village, literally, radically, with her sewing machine in hand, she has shifted her position in her family to being an asset. And no longer will her father marry her off because, in many cases, she'll end up taking care of her father and her mother as they age. She will be able to one be the one to provide monies for her brother or her sisters to go to school after 8th grade. So we know it starts with the power of one, and so we help her as we through song. Oh, the girls sing so beautifully at our college, through song, through storytelling, just through modeling of our leadership team. We prepare her both to have confidence in herself and a network of like a sisterhood, both of the girls that are in the college now and the bonds that they form, as well as the alumni that are already in these different villages and bringing them back together to be a resource for them, but also encourage in the courage that she will need to have to be the first.
That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. So these women are able. I like how you said that. I like how you said we're not looking to change Kenya, but these girls, these people that want change themselves and want to have a different path, you guys are helping provide that to them. That's just awesome.
Yeah, and I really believe, we have a Kenyan team on the grounds, that and I love LMU girls because, they understand the cultural things that I could never understand. And so they lay the groundwork that is so vital for these girls because it's hard when you can't see what's before you. And so there's a lot of uncertainty. And we know that courage, is just stepping out of your comfort zone. And so when they know that they have the strength of these strong Kenyan leaders behind them, there's a lot of shifts that happen within them. And look, it's some stories are better than others. I mean, there's just a reality with like this tidal wave that I know people here in the States feel like, how could I begin to make real change, internationally, globally? How could I really help these women that, most of us have a visceral response when we hear about female genital mutilation, for example? It's so unfair. And really, you can help change that by inserting yourself into situations where you are either helping at a local level with a charity that you believe in, or if it's an international charity, reach out to the founders, reach out to the organization, tell them you want to visit. It's an opportunity. If you have that luxury in your life to do that, I would say do it. It serves you so much better. You really it changes your life. And if you can't afford to do that, you can still insert yourself by helping organizations that are making real change. You know, we consider ourselves, we're grassroots for sure, but we consider ourselves disruptors because we are disrupting a system. You know, the cultural rituals that deny human rights to these girls. You know, at the policy level, both female genital mutilation and child bride are illegal. But and these chiefs can be held accountable, but the practical level, these girls, maybe the closest police department is hundreds of miles away. They can't get there. And so how then can we empower them? And the truth of it is that if they can financially be viable, it empowers them. Period. That's it.
So if they are financially viable, do they not have to, and I'm sorry for the ignorance of this question,
No.
experience some of the I know that they would be an asset to the family, so they wouldn't have to experience child bride. But you're when you're talking about
Female
genital
genital
mutilation,
mutilation.
yeah. When
Yeah.
I was in college, I studied well, I studied religious studies, and so learned about a lot of different religions and spiritualities around the world. And I remember at one period of time, I'd written a paper about female genital mutilation and breast ironing, and those practices in the context of the paper I was writing on religion. And so I would, if you have more information about that, like those types of things that they're facing, go ahead.
You know, I'll share with you sort of you know, how we approach the ritual of female genital mutilation. We work with both like local clerics, local priests, local nuns, which offer counseling, mentoring. They go out to the villages and discuss these issues with, you know, with the local village people. So that's one way that we help educate people on female genital mutilation. With our girls, so the owner of our college, Lucy Chango, is from a Orma tribe, and she, which is where female genital mutilation is practiced. She really leads the charge on two fronts. One is directly with the girls themselves. Many of our girls have already gone through female genital mutilation because it happens oftentimes at age 12 or 13. And by the time they're in our college, it might have been, have already happened. 15 or 16 is when they enter the college. And so the way that we see our girls impacting the conversation of female genital mutilation is exactly that. It's about educating, you know, this tidal wave of your parent, your mom, your auntie, your cousins, your sisters, that they have either are going to go through this experience or they're the ones, you know, sort of promoting this experience. And so when our girls enter this conversation, we help them understand why they need to promote that this is not a healthy practice. What is the practice itself? So I guess we're disruptors at the conversation level. And we really promote them to then pull in the resources of like have the cleric go out and talk to the village, have you know the I forget the sister's name, but have you know one of our nuns go out and talk, you know, the local nuns that work with LMU girls and work with LMU Resource Center to go out and talk to the villages as well, because we know that education is a really, really powerful piece in this. Because moms, at the end of the day, they love their kids, they love their daughters, but they have a belief system, like many of us do, that is just implanted in them at also a very, very early age. And they just, you know, they're, nothing will break it until we break it. And so that's a piece of how we see ourselves as disruptors to female genital mutilation.
So this is just a religious practice that they do.
You know,
I guess my I'm like I I'm wondering. I would love to know, if you know why they do it. If so, I can see a lot of like religious practices just being passed down, and that's just what you do. Or is there a reason?
I think that, I wish I was more of an expert on this, but I will share with you the information that I do know. I
Absolutely.
know that in some of these villages, the belief system is that, especially maybe in an area where they still practice Sharia law. So just to for those in your audience that might not know what Sharia law is, it's a law that's recognized in Kenya for Muslims to sort of practice something like an existing thing under Sharia law is that you can have up to four wives legally. And so that's one example, and I believe it's called Kadi court. So there's actually like a court system also in Kenya. It's very complicated when both the mom and the dad are legally claimed to be, Muslim. And so back to your question about why do they do this practice? It's our belief that they really do it to protect their daughters from this notion of them leaving or being unfaithful in their marriage, and that resulting in going to jail or, even punishment under Sharia law. And so as a mom, you have this belief system that if she doesn't have sexual desires, she will not be interested in, pursuing someone else outside of the marriage. Ultimately, they are protecting the girls from the ramifications of, sexual promiscuity, I guess.
Oh,
And
thank you. Okay.
that's what I believe is the underlying belief of why they would, practice this. And so ultimately, it really comes from a, I don't want to even say good place because I know we're all repulsed. But when you begin to understand that she is protecting the education piece that needs to happen, is that it's not a protection piece for her daughter. However, the tidal wave of punishment that she believes might happen if her daughter has sexual desires and leaves the marriage, then that then you begin to understand there's lots of perspectives here.
Yeah, no, I like how you said that, and you cut out a little bit, but it was only for one word,
Oh.
and no, so that's totally fine. You had just said that she believes she's protecting her daughter, and that is one thing when I was in school, in graduate school, that everything we were learning is looking at it, trying to look at it not from a Western lens, right? So
Yes.
we like you had mentioned, when we hear that, we are. I think you had said repulse. We're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But seeing it from the other side, and that could be really all the different things that from our Western lens that we're like, well, why would they do that? Or these people are
Yeah.
being oppressed in this
Yeah.
situation. But then kind of lifting, taking off those sunglasses, that lens, whatever that is, and hearing and listening the why behind it. And I'm so thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, I think that, often people, that's a little bit of this tidal wave, and even, a dear friend's response about, you can't change Africa. There's just these tribal, savage practices that happen that I don't have any influence over. I can't help. And, maybe personally and directly you can't help. But when you begin to educate these girls and you shift their position to be an equal in their communities, an equal to their husband, a role model to their little sister, someone that can talk, not talk back to their auntie, but help educate their auntie, to not do this practice. It's a way to break through, and it's a crack in the system in which we thoroughly pursue. So, the disheartening part is that oftentimes they will be outcasted if they don't go through the practice. And we know that. And we have someone in our college that understands it perfectly. And so again, about being the first, it's hard for all of us to be the first, whether you're in the States, whether in Europe, to be the first is a challenge. But when you know you're doing the right thing, which isn't inflicting pain on someone who really isn't even of age, then it helps a lot. Then you might find that 20 seconds of courage to actually say to the auntie, "No, don't do this. This is not right. I'm not going to let you do this to my sister."
How incredibly powerful these young women are, because they're not even just saying that to the auntie, it's to everybody, all of the men, the leaders, their fathers, like this, everybody that is bought in to say this specific thing and that this needs to take place. And she's not only learning that skill, so she's providing for the family so that she doesn't have to be a child bride. But I love how you're explaining all of this. It's so much more than that. She is the first, and everyone in her village is seeing that. And hopefully that's going to inspire more people, especially the younger ones that are coming up, to be the first and to speak up and to make change. And how scary and incredibly strong and powerful those young women are. I mean, because
It
I
is.
can be the first and it could be scary for me, but it is not even remotely like them being the first in their village doing what they're doing. That is amazing.
It's true. I mean, I think making change is relative, right, for all of us. And so, we really I've had some people ask me, why wouldn't she just go work in Nairobi? Why not just get a college degree and go to a big city and prosper in a way that, as Americans, in the Western lens, it's sort of like, that we're a consumer society, and so we see that as prosperous.
All
But
right.
really, she loves her family, and they love her. It's a tough life. It's something. It's really hard, and it's emotionally complex. And we really, one of the things again I love about LMU Girls is that we help them understand how they can go back to their families, and work within a system that they have. And that's really powerful. Part of our program is that they don't just get a sewing machine and sort of go off to Nairobi. If she's in any in harm's way back in her village for expressing her voice and maybe pushing back, then that's a different situation. But really, it doesn't really happen that way. I mean, the moms do love the daughters. They're helpless in many ways as well. And again, with the fathers, this is something that's been happening for years. And so a father isn't just this cruel man that, decides, you know what, you're 16, be gone. It's just it this is a practice that has been happening for years. At 16, they see them old enough. They do cost a lot of money in the past. Like, I'm not defending where the father is coming from. I'm trying to help I'm trying to help the audience understand that the father is in survival mode. The father needs, which is hard for us to put some context around, which is hunger. It's literally food and water on the table. And as in many of these villages, they do not practice birth control, again, or another religious piece in these villages. And so they'll have, eight kids and four wives. You've got 32 kids to feed. It sounds so outlandish, but real. And so I think, in trying to give it some context, we encourage our girls to really go back and, again, be the first, but as well try to help them understand the value and the symbolism that they go back to their villages for the role model, not only for the females that follow them, but also for the males. And for the father to understand, and the males in that community, the value of pushing a girl to her full potential is equal, if not greater, to the value they place on their sons.
Yes. No, I really appreciate that you're explaining all of this, because, again, with that lens that we're seeing things through, the father is not this mean, horrible person that's, like you mentioned, trying to get rid of his daughter, or thinks his daughter is worthless. It's just something that has always been there. It's an expectation. This is how things work. And I love what you're doing is that may that these women going back and being able to, well, first, the fact that these young women want to go back and make that change in their villages
Yeah,
for their
they
families,
do.
for the
They
other
do.
children that are in the village. And instead of
Yes.
just be like, peace, I'm headed to the city and I'm going to
It
prosper myself. Like, I think that's amazing. And
is
that
amazing.
by doing that, showing that, okay, this is what we've been doing for a long time. And no matter what lens you're looking at it from, we can find that everywhere in like every religion, in all different types of cultures, like certain ways that people are doing things that, there's very possibly a better way. And
Yeah.
that they're going back and saying, no, there is another way. And
Yes.
even better, where we can all really thrive and prosper, and
Yep.
without doing these practices that we're doing, that's great.
I love it too. Yeah, it's like you do what you know until you don't, until someone says, "Oh, here's a different lane we can hop in." It's really the work is incredible. I love it. I really now dedicated myself to it full time, and I am now that girl at the cocktail party that is the child bride advocate that is happy to discuss it. And but I also recognize that we live a different world over here, and so it's been so eye-opening for me as well to really with the visceral response of being so defensive and just repulsed by some of these practices, it's also so powerful to understand why the underlying root to these practices, so you can begin to make some real change. So my goal with LMU Girls is, really to put hundreds and hundreds of girls through school. And in a dream world is to start colleges, all around the world, because practices are happening, or think, girls are robbed of human rights around the world. And what a positive way to sort of empower them to have a voice, a choice, and a bank account.
A voice, a choice, and a bank account. I would love to know, how do the girls find out about the program, and how do they like raise money to be in the program? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, we are the ones that raise money for scholarships. And so in terms of identifying the girls, we work with the local clerics and the local priests, because oftentimes they're the ones, again, these villages are difficult to reach, and they're the ones that have sort of an inroads to a reputation already of trust in the villages. And so and in addition to that, our teachers and the founder of Harry Sewing College, Lucy Chango, she will also go back to the Tana River Delta area. And so we have a variety of ways that are already sort of like these inroads to the villages, where we know the families. And at this point now, the families are really coming to us. And unfortunately, because it costs roughly around $2,000 to sponsor a girl, there's more girls than there is monies at this point in time. But we hope, we as we spread the word, we hope that that will change. So when a girl is selected, we do have to have the approval of her family, because with that support and knowing she will go back, it's important for her success when she returns back to the village. And so when we say the approval of the family, really it is a dialogue about, she's not going to be, converted. Like, it's a safe environment. We're going to help her gain a skill in life. So we really talk the parents through any of the concerns that they have, to allow us to help their daughter. And then they come to the college and they live on campus. It sounds, when you think of on campus, it's really a one room sewing college and then a very simple dorm experience, where there's bunk beds, and mosquito nets and a very no electricity. The girls every day do chores, they prepare their meals. Really they form a sisterhood, a bond that's unbreakable.
Yeah, because I could imagine just for the families, the parents and older people in the families who've been doing ways a certain way their whole lives, that there's a lot of fear of the unknown. And I could
There is, yeah.
imagine fear as well of the, well, you have a Kenyan run team, so that's really good. Because I was thinking of people coming, from America and saying, hey, we want your daughter to go to this
That's
school, that would.
exactly right.
That it didn't
That's
seem
exactly
like
right.
that
And
would
that's
fly.
no, yeah, and it's just it's exactly right. We there I know I can never walk into into those sort of cultural norms. I just don't have the experience and the lens that is needed. So we really believe in the leadership coming from the Kenyans that understand where these girls live and can relate to it. And just like our teachers, they've also come from different villages and they can relate to the parents' stories. And
Right.
so
That's beautiful.
it's really just done in love. I mean, between the priests and the clerics, everybody wants goodwill to be spread. And the question is, will you spread it to girls and not just boys? And that's really where LMU Girls is a powerful organization because we're breaking that where girls have human rights and go back and are really perceived as equals. So, the beginning of it is really by the underpinning is like through probably these religious figures, as well as working with directly with the chiefs. And chiefs are really what we would consider like a mayor of a certain area.
That is amazing. Thank you for sharing all of that and helping us to understand more about the girl's story and what you're doing. This is just amazing work. I know you mentioned
Thank
you
you.
would like to have schools all over the world. What are some of the other things and maybe some upcoming plans that you have for LMU Girls?
I think for 2020, we really have gone through some shifts. Both with coronavirus, our girls right now are back in their villages, and the school is not functioning. But as soon as we can, we will be opening up the college when it's safe. We intend on trying to shift them into a bit more of like a sustainable model. So we're going to try some artisan types of products this year. The one that I'm really hoping will succeed is the last year we had in 2019, we had an LA fashion designer who was preparing for her show or her designs to be showcased in the in Paris. And she had asked me if our girls could be hired to help her sew these samples. So she flew out to Malindi and spent I think it was like six girls in the summer. She spent about 3 weeks with them and they sewed all of her samples for her Paris fashion show. And our girls got to watch it online with tears in their eyes as their samples were shared around the world. And so what we'd like to do is one of our ideas is for the girls to create like rag dolls, and all the dolls will have the little dresses that were created by the girls in for the fashion show that were featured in the fashion show. And we really want that to be a dialogue for our American girls to start talking about how they can make a difference in the world. Here we have an LA designer who just really bought two plane tickets, just a plane ticket away, and went over to Malindi and shared an experience with these girls. They collaborated together, they were creative together, they grew together. And we believe that the kids of today are the change makers and can really make a difference. And we want females here as well, young entrepreneurs, to take advantage of opportunities that they have to help those less fortunate.
Wow, that is incredible. What an amazing opportunity.
Yeah, I think the dolls are going to be adorable. We're working right now on, sourcing the materials and literally, getting patterns made by the teachers. And so it's an exciting project for us. Where there's a will, there's a way, because I don't have a background in, production, or I guess that's sort of the adventurous piece in me that sometimes you just have to eat humble pie and just figure it out. And that's what we're going to do.
That itself is so inspiring for everybody out there and listening that has a passion, that there's something that lights them up and they don't feel equipped or that they have the knowledge or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
You can make it happen. Where there's a will, there's a way, right? So you
there,
can
where there's
absolutely
a will,
figure
there's
it
a
out.
Way. Yep.
Cindy, yeah. How can people find you be able to help? So how can people find you and follow you, and how can people help?
Yeah, great questions. Thank you. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter as well, at Elimu Girls. So ELIMU Girls. And we would love to have you follow us and engage with us. You can also find us on our website, www.elimugirls.com. So ELIMUgirls.com. And a few ways to get involved is, one, you can always reach out to me. I'm available on all those channels. I answer everything, all the DMs. You can email me. So you can contact me directly, which is Cindy. And as well, you can begin to, I hope that you will buy our products that we will be featuring, our shopping section of our website. You'll sign up for our newsletter. Maybe you would be willing for your birthday to help raise money, and any gifts that you'd receive for your birthday would, you would benefit, you would donate to LMU Girls. And I'm so open to an ambassadorship program, with high schools, with colleges. So we hope over the next year to begin to develop something that has a little bit more teeth in it, with curriculum and going out and speaking to young advocates.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That is great. I will make sure that all of those links and everything are in the show notes, and
thank you.
People can access those easily in case they're, driving and don't have a pen to write that down. Cindy, Cindy, is there anything else, any parting words that you would like to leave with the audience before we part ways today?
I think the power of one, the power of one. Don't ever underestimate your power you have to make a difference. The tribe will come with you. It's important to have to build a community. You can't do everything on your own, but the power of one lies within each of us, and you just have to activate it.
Oh, I love that. Cindy, thank you so much for your time today and this beautiful, enlightening conversation. I truly appreciate you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much as well. I appreciate it.